Hello, and welcome back for another affiliate-focused branch of the UF Care Podcast, conversations with early career professionals studying addiction research here at the University of Florida, as well as providing advice and support for those entering the field. My name is Victor. I'm a second-year graduate student here in the Department of Clinical Health Psychology, working with Dr. Jeff Boisano. And today we are joined by Neo Gebru. He is a fourth-year graduate student from the Department of Health, Education, and Behavior in the lab of Dr. Robert Lehman, with research exploring key risk factors underlying health-related decision-making, particularly risky behaviors. Neo, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I saw you just put on a really nice like brown coat.
Yes, it's my Zoom coat. My fur coat, yeah.
You look very comfortable.
Thanks.
So, Neo, thank you for joining today. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I was doing a Google search online. I saw your Twitter that we talked about this a little bit. Neology is how it's spelled, but you're pronouncing it neology?
Yeah. Well, the inspiration came from like biology or psychology, so which is like the study of. So I thought neology is like the study of Neo.
The study of Neo, the study of you.
That's
insightful. Did you put like your like personal shower thoughts, philosophical musings?
Every now and again, when the mood strikes.
Yeah.
But I try to keep it professional and academic, which is cool.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I also saw that you've had a few different awards and different essays and presentations that you've put out there. As well as some involvement with different societies. So you seem very active in both the academic research side of things, but also the social sort of environmental approach to these programs.
Yeah. I think it's good having a good balance. I think service is an integral part of what we do, academia, inherently. If you look at it from the science perspective, like peer review and whatnot, we have to do our part to improve the science and ensure whatever gets out there is, you know, rigorous. But also there's a service at the end of the day, we're all human beings. So there's, it's good to do good science, but it's also good to be good people. So I try to do a good bit of service on the side to do my part for the different societies that I'm a part of. And that's also includes UF. And so I enjoy that also.
Yeah, I saw you got the Wellspring Foundation Student Award last spring. So congratulations on that and your other successes.
Thanks.
And just improving what it means to be a graduate student and a researcher.
Yeah, thanks.
So to get things started, I figured I'd offer you a chance to explain the work that you do today with this. I don't know if your dissertation, which you said you're just starting, is on the health-related decision, sort of risky behavior decision-making stuff.
Yeah.
Could you elucidate me?
Sure. Thanks for asking. Thanks for having me here today, if I didn't already say that. So my overall goals or interests, like you said, are in decision-making and judgment and risk perception. As it comes to health-related behaviors. I apply that lens specifically to study substance abuse and associated risk behaviors. And I'm particularly study alcohol use and HIV-related sexual risk-taking. So my dissertation will be applying a behavioral economic lens into alcohol use and sexual risk-taking in young adult men in an intervention setting, which we can talk about today. That's what I'm doing.
So how do you go about doing that kind of research? I know for this podcast, we've dived into pain assessments and in vivo opioid agonist kind of work. How do you assess behavioral economics?
Behavioral economics is sort of a lens. It's a framework of understanding things, really. Specifically, behavioral economics approaches things from the lens of that decisions are affected by three main things, that we consider the cost, the utility, and the risk of different things. And that can be measured using different constructs, mainly delay discounting, the demand and reinforcement of something. So I primarily study those three constructs, delay discounting, demand, and reinforcement, and how they affect behavior. And we measure each of those using different tools and tasks.
So you bring participants into the facility, or are you able to do this via telehealth?
Well, our lab does quite a bit of web-based intervention, so it's going to be a little bit of both. So my dissertation is attached to a parent study that my advisor, Dr. Rob Lehman, is running. And for that study, we'll be bringing in young adult, heavy drinking men who have sex with men. And they'll be receiving PrEP, which is an HIV prevention medication, for 30 days. So there's a lot of steps involved in that, because they have to be tested for HIV and STIs, which has to be done at a clinic. We have to take blood samples. So there's those parts that have to be done in person. And then that we also take these measurements of these different constructs, delay discounting, demand, and reinforcement, like I mentioned. And those can be done over the internet. But so far, we're doing them in person. But they can be done online too. Mm.
Yeah. What are some of the ways you assess those aspects, delay discounting and behaviors?
Yeah. So that's actually the basis of my dissertation, is the utility of these measures in assessing these constructs. So delay discounting usually is measured using monetary delay discounting. And delay discounting, I guess the audience may be familiar already, but it's the devaluation of a consequence or reward that's can be experienced at a delay. So the outcome of a behavior is usually delayed. So the choice usually is between a smaller, sooner reward and a larger, later reward, right? So usually in the monetary delay discounting, we assess that using, would you prefer $1,000 now or $10,000 at a later date? And we ask that across different trials, and you reach what's called an indifference point, where $500 in 2 weeks is probably the same as $200 now, or whatever the case may be. So that's how usually monetary delay discounting is assessed. But the literature research overall indicates that delay discounting may be a domain specific construct. And what that means is, while measuring and understanding monitoring delay discounting can tell us something about, you know, and it's associated with different substance use and other outcomes, but measuring, if we're interested, for example, in sexual behaviors, we could measure sexual delay discounting. And research shows measuring those behavior-specific delay discounting is more strongly related with those behaviors. So it's been done with food, where food delay discounting is more strongly related with BMIs. There's a hand-washing delay discounting measure, and that's been related to more OCD behaviors as opposed to just measuring OCD behaviors.
Sure.
So for sexual behavior, we study sexual behavior in my department in our lab. So my proposal, my dissertation, is essentially saying, let's use sexual delay discounting to measure these things and see if that works just as well or if better.
So this is like when you mention this, I think my experience and probably other people, when you're thinking of delay discounting, in my head, it goes to like the studies with children, where they're either given one marshmallow now or two marshmallows in, I don't know, 15 minutes or whatever. And so trying to look at that sort of assessment that the kid is doing, like, do they want this immediate gratification, or are they willing to delay that gratification in order for a different reward? So it's really cool to hear that you're doing this with sort of money behaviors and cleaning behaviors and sexual behaviors as well.
No, that's exactly right. That was Walter Michelle study, the marshmallow study, and that's been done in kids. Like you're saying, it's been shown to predict all sorts of things. And now I was just reading a paper that just came out that my advisor, Rob Lehman, worked on measuring that remotely digitally. And that's been showing to have some predictive value as well. So we can measure all sorts of these things, all sorts of different ways. So, yeah.
What does it tell you?
So there's a paper called Amy Odom wrote a while back now, mm-hmm. maybe 20 years ago. It's called I'm a K, You're a K. And it's essentially describing what is delay discounting. And it depends on how you want to interpret it. So some say it's a personality trait. Is it like, we assign you this delay discounting value, and that's, you know, how impulsive you are overall. But we know also impulsivity is sort of a catch-all term, and that it encompasses sort of, like you're saying, you know, lack of delaying gratification, urgency, and these different things. So delay discounting, and that's why I want to measure delay discounting specific to sexual delay discounting, because it is sort of behavioral and context dependent. I think I have this in my Twitter bio, ABC, which is why I study addictions using behavioral economics, and the C is in context. So the context matters on how you interpret these things.
I see that. Yeah. I got your Twitter open right now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the context matters. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So learning about the context in which these decisions can be made and how they sort of fit this individual's profile, how does this tie into your dissertation work? When you do these assessments, when you bring this population in, what are you hoping to learn for the future?
Yeah, so the idea sort of came out of just conversations I was having with my advisor. So when I first came into UF working with an advisor who's no longer here, Dr. Ritchie, and he was more focused on behavioral economics. And that's why I came to grad school, was to learn more about behavioral economics. So we were having conversations, and we had actually ran a couple of studies to test this idea of it's called risk compensation. And the idea is that whenever there's a risk-reducing technology introduced in any context in a decision-making scenario, mm-hmm. that people are more likely to take risks. And that was studied in all sorts of things. When seatbelts were first introduced, people were driving a little bit more dangerously. When helmets were first introduced, people that wear helmets took a little bit more risk than people that were biking without helmets. So whenever there's a risk reducing technology, in this case, the helmet or the seatbelt, people took more risk. So that was applied to the HIV literature, in that whenever PrEP, like I was mentioning, that was the medication, which is a risk reducing technology. Mm-hmm. So PrEP is a medication that you take every day, or anyone can take every day, an HIV negative person can take it. And even if you are exposed to HIV, the likelihood of you getting HIV is minimal. It's essentially zero. It's been studied specifically in men who have sex with men, but it's been shown in women and across the board. And it's a highly efficacious drug, but it requires a strong adherence. It doesn't last too long in our body, so people have to take it essentially every day. There's some literature that's coming out now that you can take it on demand. So if you can plan out, okay, I'm going to have sex in a couple of days, so you can take it 2 days before, the day before, and the day after, or something like that. And it's been proven to be efficacious. But regardless, so PrEP in the HIV literature is equivalent to the helmet or the seatbelt. It reduces the chances that you get HIV. So the idea is, some folks have proposed, is what if we give PrEP out, are people then going to take more risk, more sexual risk taking? And of course, that's dangerous, or I shouldn't say dangerous. It has deleterious outcomes, because while PrEP offers protection from HIV, it doesn't offer any protection against various STIs, chlamydia, syphilis, gonorrhea. And all of these things are now in the States, we're seeing record highs. 2019 was all-time high for, I think, three of those STDs. And the problem is local too. In Gainesville is considered one of the top 50 states for STD cases in all of America. So we see, while PrEP uptake is increasing, we see these STDs are also going up. We're stopping HIV, but STDs are going up, and these STDs are becoming normalized a little bit, but they're associated with several long-term outcomes too. So the idea for me, I know it's sort of a long story.
No, please, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, but the idea there is that, so my advisor study is going to be giving PrEP to these men who have sex with men, young adult, they're going to be heavy drinking too. That's an eligibility criteria. But he has he's developed this web-based, mobile-based intervention that is seeking to reduce their alcohol use while also hoping to increase their PrEP adherence. Like I mentioned, PrEP requires a strong regimen. So, and that's going to happen over a period of 30 days. So my proposal is essentially measuring their sexual risk-taking before they take PrEP and after, a month later, to see if there is an actual difference. Do people actually take more risk once they start taking PrEP? And that's what's missing in the literature. We don't know that. There's not a lot of prospective studies. A lot of it is comparing PrEP users with non-users. So this will be one of the few prospective studies that's looked at sexual risk taking and measuring it in different ways. Like I mentioned, sexual delay discounting, we'll be doing self-reports, etc. So I'm excited to get that going.
Absolutely. That sounds like it's one of those studies that you describe, and it makes me think, why hasn't this happened yet? Why don't we know? why don't we know this? Like, probably, but we won't know for sure until we have the data and we can look at it and make an informed assessment. What would then be, I don't know if you've put thought this far ahead, since I know you're still at the beginning of this project, what would then be actions taken if the hypothesis is proven correct?
Well, the study will have several hopefully beneficial outcomes, right? So like I said, the sexual delay scientifically or from a research perspective, like I said, the sexual delay discounting is it's a massive step forward in behavioral research, because so far we rely on self-reports. We ask people to tell us honestly and openly about these really sensitive behaviors, about their sexual behaviors. That's open to, you know, recall bias, desirability bias, et cetera. So if we can test and showcase the utility of this case, the sexual delay discounting task, which is a scenario-based task, we show them different pictures and how likely are you to use a condom in different scenarios. So we can measure their sexual risk-taking using this measure without having to rely on people telling us, you know, their deepest and darkest stories.
Sure.
Then that will be a huge step forward in for the literature. And more practically and clinically, so that's a huge reduction on reliance on self-report. So that's huge. And then also examining behavior change over time. Like you're saying, we know these ideas, but they haven't really been tested over time prospectively. So research-wise, those are two important steps forward. And clinically, if we can show that this scale, that this measure can reliably predict real-life behavior, that's a tool that clinicians can use to say, okay, who should we give PrEP to, or not necessarily who to determine who to give PrEP to, but which population is most at risk. So they get a little bit more education, a little bit more counseling, a little bit more accompanying PrEP, because PrEP works, like I said, but it needs to be accompanied by strong regimen and counseling and overtime advice with the physicians.
Learning who should be targeted for specific follow-ups.
So this is a serious problem, because while we're trying to figure out all these issues from the research perspective, it's having real life consequences, because at least a quarter of physicians report lack of willingness to prescribe PrEP to folks that need it. And this is a potentially life-saving medication. And just because we think, you know, people are going to engage in more risk-taking doesn't mean we should keep that away from them. So hopefully it'll have a big implications. I don't want to oversell the study.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's the thing. We can lay out hypotheses, hopes for research, and looking at established studies, be able to create informed prediction as to how things might shape up. But we can't know for sure. Even saying, like, once the data proves, data doesn't really prove anything. It gives us a direction. Yeah. And hopefully, Neo, you get a strong direction.
you and me both.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about how you got to be doing this kind of work? What first interested you with behavioral economics?
I don't like it when people start answering this question and they always say, well, my trajectory is always as non-traditional. So I don't want to say my path was non-traditional as well.
There is no traditional path. Right, right.
Yeah, that is what I'm learning. So my background is in psychology and specifically in clinical psychology. I was at in the program at University of Maryland. But I started doing therapy and providing clinic work, and I wasn't good at it and I didn't like it. So I decided to to get my master's from there and leave. But I made strong connections. I really enjoyed the work that I was doing there. I was in a substance abuse lab there. So I worked with some people there that really exposed me to view addictions from a sort of a holistic perspective. I didn't know too much about it until then. And it just so happened my advisor there worked with a colleague that was moving down to Florida. And we just started talking about this idea of behavioral economics. And I just did some reading and I just found I had the ideas for it. I just didn't have the words for it. So he gave me some reading to do and I just sort of fell in love with it. It just captures, I like behavior. I like numbers. And it sort of married those ideas well.
That's excellent. I'm glad you were able to find your way to an area of research that you really enjoy.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I think that's important. Yeah, research can be hard at times, but
yeah. And it's important, I think, that you took the time to reflect. I'm currently in a clinical psych program right now. Moving to the end of my master's, that stage. Yeah. You know, it's important to reflect and think: is this what I really want to be doing? Is this is this the work that I want to be engaged with? The people that I want to learn from and grow to emulate. It's great to hear that you took that time for yourself and set yourself on a better path.
Yeah, no, thank you. I highly recommend that. I do, like you were saying at the beginning, I do some service work. I have mentees. I don't want to say everybody should take a gap year or anything like that. But I think we could be a little bit more intentional, all of us, about the choices we make about our training. Just about our career path. So, I'm kind of glad it worked out for me that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So Neil, what comes next? Say you finish this study and dissertation goes without a hitch. Everything looks good.
Yeah.
You graduate.
Yeah. I like academia. I'll probably stay in academia. I will stay in academia. I'm looking at postdocs right now. I don't know exactly where yet. I haven't tied myself down to an idea. As you probably figured out, just throughout the different changes that I expressed, my mentor leaving, me finding behavioral economics and whatnot, my overall interest is substance misuse and risky behaviors. That is the universal problem I want to spend my life's work addressing, but I'm not tied to like any particular approach or a research question, which I think bodes well for me. I think we have to be a little bit pragmatic with academia and grants and whatnot. There's a lot of our control, but I will stay in academia. I enjoy the ability to find a problem that you care about and come up with the solution. I think there's no better way to spend my time. So I'm looking at postdocs right now. Brown, Yale, USC are attracting me. They seem attractive. So we'll see where I end up, but definitely a postdoc in the immediate future. And then we'll see.
Sure. It'll be interesting to check back in a few years and see where this path has taken you. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You too.
Yeah. Cool. Well, as we wrap up this conversation, Neo, thank you for your time. Is there any piece of advice that you would like to pass on to folks just beginning their journey into the world of research and addiction, behavioral economics?
I feel like we're just sort of scratching the surface, there's so much to dig there. But I mean, I guess an overall advice would be, if you're interested, not just in research, but if whatever you find interesting, just follow that intuition. And just, I like I said, I think we can all be a little bit more intentional. I think I remember just being a little, just not, a little bit intimidated, you know, as an early career, just when I was starting my training and just my career overall, of just sending an email or whatever the case may be. And it's usually those small steps that help move your career and your training forward. So yeah, I would say just, you know, if you're interested in substance abuse, I'm happy to, you know, to answer any questions. If anyone is interested, shoot me an email or DM me on Twitter.
Twitter, at Neology, like three or four O's.
Yeah.
Three O's.
I should probably make a website. That has been my pandemic project that I
Make a website.
Yeah, no, yeah, at some point I will.
That SEO. So yeah,
I think, yeah, and all my free time of between my dissertations. Right. I'll get on that one of these days. But yeah, no, I would say that's my general advice is just, you know, follow your intuition and just do the work that you enjoy. Cause if you do, if you enjoy your work, then it's not really work, I find. So yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, Neo. I appreciate your time today. We also want to give a thanks to the University of Florida Center for Addiction Research and Education. That's the CARE of CarePod. As well as Dr. Oliver Grundman, Dr. Sarah Jo Nixon, Dr. Joanne Paris, and all of our mentors and future collaborators. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.